The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Texas Show.
They say it takes a big man to admit he's wrong, but I say it takes an even bigger man to admit he's never wrong.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you that bigger man, Eric Metaxas.
Folks, welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. I always try to bring you interesting guests. As you know, if you're a regular listener to this program, I fail terribly. But sometimes the gods smile upon us. And I have to say, today we have a guest I'm very, very excited to bring to you for the first time on this program. His name is Douglas Murray. He is the author of The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. He's an editor at The Spectator. He sounds like he's from England, but who knows where he's really from. Douglas Murray, welcome to this program.
It's great to be with you, Eric.
I understand that you're in fact not in merry old England as we speak.
No, I'm in your country. I'm in the USA. I'm touring around all month until after the election. I've been in a number of states so far. As we speak, I'm in sunny Portland, Oregon, and moving on tomorrow to another state. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, have a cup of coffee and perhaps some hemlock while you're there, because it's very depressing, yes, as I understand. You know, technically, Portland is no longer part of America, just so you understand. Your passport means nothing there. And if flames begin to lick at the foundations of your domicile, just get out and we'll do the interview at another time.
You'll know if that happens, that it wasn't an accident.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's the problem. Well, listen, you've written a book previous to this one. This one is The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. Before that, you wrote The Strange Death of Europe. It seems to me that the two are linked, or at least they sound linked in my worldview. But let's start with the new book, The Madness of Crowds. Talk about the thesis of that book, if you would.
Well, basically, what this book has in common with the one before is that, in my view, our societies, by this I mean Western democracies, particularly the English-speaking democracies, are suffering from, among much else, a colossal want of meaning. We have a God-shaped hole in our society, and I don't even make that observation as a religious person, I make it as a historian. There is a God-shaped hole in the society which things keep on trying to fill. And things that try to fill them are, in my view, a lot worse than the things that they claim to be replacing. Now, in recent years, in the last decade in particular, the main thing that has flooded into this sphere has been a set of identity politics claims, which young Americans are being brought up with as a not just purpose for life, but a meaning in life. They are being told that everything to do with LGBTIQA, or however long the alphabet is today, everything to do with men and women, particularly women's rights, everything to do with women, everything to do with race, that these things are ongoing battles. And for them to live a meaningful life, they should engage in these battles, they should fight these battles, they should seek to win these battles, and that they should prepare to struggle in them for the rest of their lives and find meaning that way. Now, I explain at some length, first of all, why this is a highly undesirable life goal. Secondly, I explain why it cannot work on its own terms. All of the things that the intersectionalists and all this other postmodernist mumbo jumbo has become is not going to work on its own terms. It's entirely self-contradictory. And the third thing is, but I say you have to find a way through these madnesses, this maddening of the modern era. You have to find a way through, encourage your friends and family to find a way through, and find a life of real meaning on the other side, because otherwise an entire generation is not just at risk of assaulting America and the freedoms that they actually should be enjoying. It's going to be a system that is going to waste their energies and their life. So the aim that I have is not just to have some fun with these people, and I can assure you I do because they are ludicrous, but to try to make sure that people being brought up in this thought system get around it and out of it as fast as humanly possible.
Well, your book comes festooned, as I like to say, with encomia, no less than Jordan Peterson has said, Douglas Murray fights the good fight for freedom of speech, a truthful look at today's most divisive issues. And then Joe Rogan calls it an excellent take on the lunacy affecting much of the world today. Douglas is one of the bright lights that could lead us out of the darkness. This seems to me to be the crisis of our time. And it's so deep, Douglas, that it is hard to know where to begin. Any of us who sees the madness of it, we see the madness of it. But then to begin to parse it, to dissect it, to say, where did it come from? How did it arise? First of all, your book, The Madness of Crowds, is kind of a sidewise reference to Hardy's book, Far From the Madding Crowd. What is it about crowds that has anything to do with intersectionality and with woke culture?
Well, first, yes, we have, and there are a lot of historians, Elias Canetti and many others who've written on this, we have a tendency as human beings to want to be part of the crowd. You know this very well as a historian. I know it as a historian and writer as well, that at most times in history, most people want to just get along with whatever the prevailing wind is in the time. And relatively small numbers of people at any point in history are willing to walk against the prevailing trend. Now, what the radical activists always do, what they always know they have to do, is to try to work to make that prevailing wind work in their favor. And in America, in the most recent generation, they have been extraordinarily successful at that. If even 10 or 15 years ago, you and I had been sitting here and one of us had referred to intersectionality, the other would have said, you what? What's this? Apart from the ugliest word in the language, what exactly is this? Let alone major papers of record using it on a regular basis. If people had been, even 10 or 15 years ago, talking about things like white fragility, white privilege, and much more, we just said, what exactly are you talking about? Now, I explain in The Madness of Crowds, we know exactly what they're talking about. Because since the 1970s in the US, a set of scholars and radical activists from the radical left made sure that a new system of thought pushed its way out from the academy into the mainstream of American culture. It had various, not even ideas, assertions that it made. It asserted a set of things about America. It asserted things about the nature of society. It claimed, it never proved, it claimed that America was a patriarchal, cis-heteronormative, institutionally racist society. And there, from then, it told a generation of students that this was the case. And the crack that I and many others identified as being on the right, I don't particularly care for these labels these days. I think it's all sane people against the madness. But those of us who were identified as being on the right used to have a crack about this that went along the following lines, which was, you know, your daughter goes off to, Berkeley, impoverishes her parents who have to remortgage the house for her to take a degree in lesbian dance theory. And at the end of the degree, she comes out and makes the stunning discovery that there isn't much of a market in the job market for people who have a PhD in performative lesbian dance. Now, that used to be the crack that people on the right used to make. They used to say the market will assert itself. It will show that it will teach a lesson to these people. No, far from it. There turned out to be many, many jobs for these people to go to. They went into jobs as diversity officers in institution after institution, not just in the universities, but in Fortune 500 companies.
Right.
It's why every corporation today in America, and this is the thing that staggered me most, I was expecting the lunacy in the universities and even government. I was not expecting it in the corporations. These corporations across America have all bought into this. It's gone far deeper than we knew.
I want to pick up right there. Folks, I'm talking to Douglas Murray. The book is The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. We'll be right back.
This closet's always stacked. The dealer's in the basement.
Folks, I'm talking to Douglas Murray. His new book, The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity, is the topic of discussion. Douglas, you're saying so much. We just left off talking about corporate America. That, to me, is the most horrific part of this, in the sense that the free market and the market typically is what stood as a bulwark against madness, that when people got out into the real world and got out into the corporate world, they would understand, I can't show up at work dressed as a slob. I have to show up on time. I have to do a good job. They will not grade me on effort. All of these basics, it's like dealing with science. It's just there and you have to deal with it. Corporate America has, with tremendous cravenness, bought into these ideologies. It's the sort of thing that I don't think the founders of the United States could have anticipated. How do you see this happening? How has this progressed so rapidly among top corporations?
Well, it's a very important question, this, because I say it's very baffling to a lot of people. They sort of think, well, the banks won't get into this rubbish. You know, the energy companies won't get into this rubbish. Far from it. They've all welcomed it. Now, I have a number of explanations for this, one of which is this. In the last 10 years in particular, when the so-called woke stuff has flooded through the companies and corporations, in the last 10 years, it is the cheapest thing that a lot of companies can do to embrace this stuff. That is, take after the 2008 financial crash, when there's appalling behavior in financial institutions across the Western world. In the wake of that crash, there's quite a number of things that could have happened with those corporations. They could have had to have paid a real price. Instead, they paid the cheapest price imaginable because they bought people off with the cheapest don't hurt us, let the mob pass us by tactics. My own bank in the UK started doing a Pride Month. I mean, it was almost Pride Year, where they would have big signs up all over the bank, a big gay rainbows saying love happens here. And when that started happening, I said, you know, I don't want love to happen at my bank. It's about the last thing I want at the bank. I just want you to be able to print out my monthly statements more efficiently. But all of these things started to play these weird games. When you think about it, it's because if they can present themselves as being right up there on the front of LGBT rights, people don't ask questions about what exactly they were doing in 2008 with the crash. If corporation after corporation talks about the need to get more diversity officers, the hope, and by the way, it's quite successful, is that the mob will pass them by. It's the same thing I've seen in houses across America, particularly in the places where the riots happen. People put up BLM posters, whether they agree with that movement or not, because they want the mob to pass by their house. They are don't hurt me posters.
And this is what you're saying. I mean, I have said this, and it's wonderful to hear you say it. And you have some credentials to say these things that I don't have. You openly identify as gay. You're an atheist. So in other words, you're not talking about what someone's point of view is. You're talking about what is the proper role of corporations. We've seen this with churches. They put out the BLM banner or the rainbow banner. And I think, why are they doing that? It seems to me They're saying, don't hurt me. Don't lump me in with the haters. That's and right. Unfortunately, I draw the parallel with the early and mid 30s in Germany, where everybody was on board to put up the swastika long before anyone dreamt of death camps. But they simply said, we need insurance against the mobs. We need insurance against the cocked eyebrow. We just need to make sure that everyone knows we're okay. We're not against you. And it's the very moment for people, particularly in churches, to say, this is what we believe. We have never been haters here. We have never been racists here. So the idea that we would need to somehow advertise the latest thing to prove that, that alone makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's right. And by the way, as you know, the situation with the churches is yet further evidence of the way in which this has just flooded across the system. Again, like the banks, but on a much bigger scale, people would think at least the churches will hold on to what they believe. At least the churches won't fall to the mob. But as you know, I mean, not least in your wonderful, if I may say so, book on Bonhoeffer, it is a very small number of people who ever at any time say no. And here's one of my challenges to the American public at this stage. We're not in the situation of 1930s Germany. There are certainly parallels, there are echoes, as you know, and as you just said, but we aren't in the situation that people were in then. We're not dealing with a totalitarian system at the moment that would put people in death camps. You know, we are dealing with radical activists who are lying about this society. So when people say to me, you know, I'm worried about saying what I think, my boss has given me a reading list of books so that I can correct my thoughts and much more, I say to them, you aren't going to a death camp. You are not threatened by very much compared to people in almost any point in history. So don't be quiet. Don't give in to the mob. Stand up. Speak up.
Well, it's why I wanted to have you on this program and why I say much of what I say. I think that there are people struggling for a vocabulary, struggling for arguments. They're not quite sure how to respond. That's and right. They take the path of least resistance. And I want to warn people that if you do that, you contribute to what some German sociologists in the 30s called the spiral of silence. In other words, if you go along to get along, you are contributing to making it more and more difficult for principled voices to speak up. You are part of silencing those who would speak up. So everyone needs to do something. But I argue that in America, people are sort of in love with being liked, right? And it's one of our national virtues, and it's also the great sin of America. When Bonhoeffer came here, he noticed this, that everyone sort of wants to get along. They're not so much interested in truth. And I think this is the difficulty, that we are being told you either can get along or you can be a pariah. And I think those of us who know better, we want to encourage them to say, no. Yeah. There are many people who think the way you do. If only you might speak up a little bit, you'll see they'll come out of the woodwork.
Exactly. This is the absolutely key issue. You know, we have this phrase in this society, the silent majority. We have it in my country. And I always say the same thing. Why the heck should the majority ever be silent? Why? It's completely counterintuitive. Why should radical actors who maybe constitute maybe just about a double-digit percentage of the population have the capacity and the capability to silence the majority? Why should it have been the case in the last 4 years that people have to silently admit that they voted for the winning candidate in the election? Any election. It's the same in my own country with the Brexit vote. People sidle up to me and say, I voted for Brexit as well. And I say, I did, like the majority of the public. It's not an unusual position. And indeed, even if Donald Trump had lost in 2016 or the Brexit vote had gone the other way in 2016, you're still dealing with a large percentage of the population. Why the heck should they be silent?
Well, I say the same thing. Who elected Donald Trump? It's called the United States of America. You don't need to talk about his base or anything. Who elected him? America elected him. And if you have disdain for America and the American way of government to the extent that you say he's not your president, something is wrong with you and you need to be called out on that. That's inappropriate. It's unacceptable. But they pretend as though something about him rises to the level of requiring their resistance. Yes. and gives them permission to do things that are unconstitutional and ugly that they never would have done before.
But they have made a historic mistake on this, by the way. I mean, you know, I say people should use their historical parallels very carefully. And America has been using its historical parallels with extraordinary abandon in recent years. I mean, that major figures in the media and politics could have consistently for the last 4 years pretended that the American president was akin to Mussolini, Hitler, and any number of reprehensible dictators from the 1930s is astonishing. And yet they've done it. They have. And when I see the results of this on the streets in rioting in America, this is the creation of politicians who have been perfectly willing to pretend that the elected president of the United States is effectively a Hitler-like figure. Well, if that is the case, and I always challenge them when I speak to people, and they, of course, they very rarely want to speak in public, in my opinion, with me. They very rarely want to debate, as you know, because their ideas are very weak, actually. When I do get a chance to speak to these people, I always say to them, you know, if the president was Hitler, then you've got to shoot him. You've got to shoot him. Historically, we all know that everybody has the time travel theory. So they don't really believe it in one way. They are doing performative violence. And what they have to realize is that performative violence at some stage leads to the real thing.
Hang on, because this is a wonderful conversation, folks. Don't go away. I'm talking to Douglas Murray. The new book is The Madness of Crowds. We'll be right back. Investors seeking steady cash flow, ready to diversify? NRIA has grown to be one of the nation's leading specialists and offers 10% annualized monthly payouts with bonuses targeted at 18 to 21%. That's right. You could receive steady 10% return monthly payments with bonuses. As their slogan says, they specialize in realty investing done right. You can even use your 401k or IRA to invest. NRIA's 15-year track record and $1.2 billion in new construction development backs you. Learn how you can invest in this hard asset real estate cash flow fund today and receive 10% annualized monthly payouts with bonuses. This is something savvy investors should research and consider. Call now 800-700-5483. That's 800-700-5483 or visit NRIA.net.
An offer to buy or sell any security is only made by our private placement memorandum. Read it first. See us at NRIA.net.
Folks, I got some embarrassing news to share with you, but you know what? This is just the kind of a show where I don't care. I'm willing to lay my heart, you know, on the line. Here's the issue. Mike Lindell with MyPillow, you may notice that I have a bobblehead of him near me. He's here to remind all of us that when you go to MyPillow.com, you get whopping discounts if you use the code Eric, okay? Now, there are a lot of people who haven't done that, and we have your names here. And Chris Himes and Albin pointed out to me that there's like three pages of you whose first name is Eric. You yourself, I mean, that's humiliating for me that even though your name is Eric, you're still not willing to use the code Eric. I mean, if you don't want to use it because it's my name, use it because it's your name. But the point is that I see who you are, and I just feel humiliated by this. Please go to MyPillow.com. It's okay, Mike. It's going to be okay. Go to MyPillow.com. Use the code Eric. You're going to get whopping savings and really high quality products. Did I mention that? Thank you. Folks, I'm talking to Douglas Murray. He is an editor at The Spectator. He is the author of a book called The Strange Death of Europe, which I'd love to talk about, if not today, another time. And the new book is The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. Douglas, you just said that people are absurdly comparing this president to actual dictators. And I think what they don't realize is how incredibly ignorant and ill-educated they look when they make these stupid comments. Mm. Innumerable people have called me out as being, crazy for not understanding my own book on Bonhoeffer. And I think that's the whole point. I wrote the book. I understand what actual dictatorship looks like. And this ain't it. We're not even close. If somebody raises their voice, they say, that's just like Hitler. That's enough for them. I think what this speaks to is roughly 50 years of lack of civics education in America. Most Americans don't have the beginning of an idea of what liberty is, what it looks like, what the opposite of it looks like. And so they can just sort of speak emotionally and there's no pushback.
That's right. And I mean, I don't wish to be rude to the country I'm in, but this country has had a failure of education for at least two generations, which is coming to roost now. I mean, people throw around this one historical analogy basically because they don't even have reference to anything else. You can see from the young people and others who are pulling down the statues of everybody in the American past, they don't know anything about the American past. They know nothing. I stood the other day by the statue of Teddy Roosevelt, where it had been in Portland, where like every other statue here, it's been pulled down. Portland is nothing but a whole array of empty plinths at this point. And I don't see the tourists coming back for the plinth tour. I stood by the statue to Teddy Roosevelt, and where it had been, I asked these young people who were just standing around by, what do you think of this statue not being here anymore? And they kind of didn't really know anything much about it. Well, we're not really with that. And I said, do you know who he was? And one of them said, isn't it something to do? It's the Second World War. I said, no, that was Franklin. That was Franklin D. Roosevelt. But why should a British guy have to come to America and explain your presidents to the ignoramuses on the street when they've been put through public education at considerable cost to this country and with so little effect? It's the same with the slavery question. You hear people saying things like, we've never addressed the question of slavery. What are you talking about? Have you heard of this thing called the Civil War that happened? They don't. And the thing is, here it is. They don't know. It's ignorance with presumption layered on top. And this is now the consequence of it. They think they know all about history. They've got so many theories about it. And they're all wrong. And they're all rooted in ignorance. And too few adults in America have been willing to turn around to them and point this out. We do not need to hear from people this ignorant. We do not need to give in to people this ignorant. We shouldn't be listening to people this ignorant.
I love that you're saying that, because of course it's true. And before I forget, let me thank you for using the word plinths on this program. It's an important word. No one's ever used it on this program before. But the idea, as you're saying, that we have this tremendous ignorance among people educated in our public schools at great cost, it seems to me that this has everything to do with the long march through the institutions, that the cultural Marxists, Gramsci, Marcuse, they were doing something that has finally borne fruit. We have teachers' unions in America that are addicted to power, that are left-wing, that don't seem to care about the things that they're being paid to care about. I mean, we can start there. That, of course, is the idea this is happening not at the undergraduate level, but at the K through 12 level. It's been happening for a long time. And then, of course, colleges have been utterly taken over by crazy Marxists. I mean, I remember I was at Yale in the 80s, and this was very, very clear there at that time. This is not a new thing. When Buckley writes about Yale of the 40s, he writes about it in his book, God and Man at Yale. So this has been something that's been percolating along among the elites. We know that it was in England following the First War, and that finally now it has come to full bloom among the masses who get to vote.
That's right. And of course, one of the most disturbing things about this is that this movement, which you identify, which has been going on for some decades in America, has at the end of it this fruit which says everything in the society is rotten. Everything about America is irredeemable. This is what we get. We get this. This is no longer a fringe thing. It's not just from academia. It's not a few wacky people at Wellesley College or something that you can just dismiss and because they publish unreadable papers. No, it's not that. It's the New York Times. It's the 1619 Project. This is an organized effort to say America is exceptional only in one way. It's exceptionally evil and bad. These are people who seem to be teaching and seem to be claiming that it would have been better if America had never been discovered. I ran a piece about this recently in The Spectator. There seems to be now a presumption that it would have been better after the Europeans discovered America if they'd have gone back home and said, shh, nothing to see there. We've discovered a continent, but we should leave it be. Yes. Don't take any interest in it. And these, because otherwise we're going to have slavery and a whole lot of other stuff.
Yeah, which people, of course we've never had in any other part of the world except America. Yeah. And only white people have been guilty of enslaving others. Yeah. Fascinating. Well, we're going to go to a break. We'll be back. Another segment with Douglas Murray. The book, folks, is The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. Don't go away. Folks, I'm talking to Douglas Murray, and you're enjoying it. I know you are, because here you are. The Madness of Crowds is the title of his book. Douglas, what more shall we cover? There is so much. We're talking about, you know, this is the Philosopher's Stone. Everything seems to point to what we're talking about at this point.
That's right. It's an extraordinary time in this nation's history because the whole question of this nation's validity is up for grabs at the moment. You know, there are people who honestly seem to think that America is as reprehensible and appalling as they are being told by the New York Times and many other publications. And then there are people, and this is a key thing, there are people in this country who instinctively know that this stuff is not true. You know, and they know that they look around the world. I mean, I'm very fortunate to travel a lot around the world. So I know this, you know, with my own eyes. But a lot of people just have it as a gut instinct. They think, I don't think that America can be these things. Or, as we said just before the break, didn't everyone do bad things in history? You know, wasn't history kind of tricky for everyone? Or was it just us? They know this. They know that they're being fed subtle lies that become huge lies. And I really hope that one of the things that can be done, and it's what I try to do in The Madness of Crowds, is that the people who instinctively know something is up, who know that America is not a patriarchal, you know, homophobic, transphobic, biphobic, all the other boring terms, and institutionally racist society. The people who instinctively know that that's a totally unfair estimation of this society need to know, firstly, what they're dealing with their radical opponents and the extent of their claims, and secondly, how to push back against them. And I try to give people some of the armory to do that. And that's what's needed. We need to have more people standing up and saying, no, I will not have this said because I know it to be untrue. And I am very confident about this. You know, in my previous book, The Strange Death of Europe, I was very bleak about the situation there because there's a lot of problems with the immigration, the Islam question in Europe. It's a very bleak subject. The subject I tackle in The Madness of Crowds, of the deranging ideas of the time that have flooded across America, I'm actually quite hopeful about because I think we can win. I think in a competition between people who think that America is the worst country in the world and people who know that that is a lie, I think the second group are likely to win in the long term. All we need is for more people to speak up, not to just make their voice heard at the ballot box every fourth year or something like that, but to speak up with their loved ones, with their family, with their friends, with their co-workers. You know, I come back to this thing. If the silent majority stopped being silent, the situation wouldn't be as it is. And that's my call. That's my suggestion. And I think it's winnable.
Well, it's funny you say that because it seems obvious that there is something in the American culture where people, they're afraid to speak up. And I think to myself, you know, if this were East Germany, where you could be hauled off to some prison, if this were North Korea or even China. What is at stake? Are people so cowardly and so comfortable? I think that's really what it is. In other words, we are so tremendously blessed that we are so comfortable that getting up off the couch seems like a heroic thing. And I think that's the problem, that we really don't know what it is to suffer. We don't want to give up the tiniest bit of comfort. And when you think that people around the world are being beheaded for their faith, being murdered for their ideology, I just have to say that if we in America don't begin to get real and understand that we still have outrageous levels of freedom that we're wasting, that's dripping away day by day, if we don't use the freedom that we've been given, which we don't deserve, but we have as a gift, you know, then I think things are going to continue to drift. But I like you, have faith that there are enough American people who understand these things and who are finally being pushed to the wall and infuriated. I think some of what we've seen about the way the press has refused to cover certain scandals and has gone after this president over nothing, the Russia hoax, I can't even begin to believe that that happened. It makes the tulip craze seem rational. But I really do think that Americans finally are waking up, or being forced to wake up and get up off the couch.
That's right. You know, as I referred to earlier, you know, I've traveled a lot in my life. I've gone to a lot of the places which people are fleeing from, as well as the places they flee to. And some years ago, I was covering a war in northern Nigeria, where Boko Haram had been persecuting, ethnically cleansing, religiously cleansing Christians from the area, massacring people in their churches on Easter Sunday and much more. And one of the most moving things I've ever seen in my life was at a service in the northeast at one of the remaining churches. And the entirely packed congregation said prayers I'd said since childhood, including the Lord's Prayer. And when they got to the line, "Deliver us from evil," it was spine tingling, because everybody in the room had to be delivered from evil. They had all run from people trying to kill them. They'd seen their loved ones killed. These people in Nigeria had paid such a price for their faith. This is real sacrifice. What is happening in America need not be. I have had people say to me in recent days in the US, one said to me, "I think people are worried that they're not going to be invited to a cocktail party in Georgetown."
Yeah.
I said, "I've been to a cocktail party in Georgetown. It isn't worth hoping to go to again." Why are people in America wooed by unnecessary forms of affirmation? If you are right, if you're in the right, if you are fighting against evil and fighting against lies, you don't need to belong to any other club. Even if it was just you, the club of one would be the only one worth being in.
Well, we don't really have time to get into it, just about 40 seconds, but where do you get your spine, as it were, from? Because everything you say is right. Where do you get it from if you're not a person of faith?
Well, I was brought up as a person of faith, of course, and I think that it's very important for people to realize that the foundations of your life are exceptionally important. And I say that of myself, about the clearest explanation I can give is I loathe lies. I always have done. It's what makes me a writer. It's what made me a journalist. I loathe lies. I don't want them in my society. I want them to go away. I don't want them to waste my time. I want us to get on with doing more meaningful things in our lives, because we can.
Well, you're an atheist who believes in meaning and in good and evil and in lies and truth, which means we have a lot in common. I'd love to continue talking to you. I'd like to do that as soon as possible. Douglas Murray, just a privilege to get this time. The book, folks, is The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. Thanks for listening. Hey there, folks. Welcome back. Guess what? Yes, I'm going to ask you a question now, and the answer is either yes or no, and I want you to be honest with me. I try to be honest with you folks. Oh, I fail. I know I fail, but I try. Here's my question to you. We're doing a campaign with the Alliance Defending Freedom. We're begging every one of you to give something, anything, a small amount, a non-small amount, either will do. And the question is, have you done that? Yes or no? Go.
Wait. Yes or no? Those are the two? Okay, yes or no?
Those are the two.
Okay.
It's multiple choice. A, yes, B, no. Now, if the answer is B, and I want you to be honest, now you have something to do today. And I say this very sincerely. When we say we want you to give any amount, it means we want you to give any amount. So if you've got $5 burning a hole in your pocket, $20, $100, it doesn't matter. We want everyone to participate, because when they come for you or your friend or your teacher or the guy down the street who runs a bakery or someone else, and they start giving him grief, you can say, well, I gave to the Alliance Defending Freedom, and maybe my friend or whoever can contact the Alliance Defending Freedom, because this is what they do. They defend people who are being wrongly attacked. They defend them in the court of law for free. So, you know, if somebody comes into your store and says, I know that you're very pro-Jewish, but I've got a cake that I'd like you to bake. And it is, it's for the PLO. We're raising money for the PLO. By the way, I hate Jews. Oh, well, you're going to be able to say, I can't do that. It goes against my conscience. I can't bake a Jew-hating cake. I hope you don't mind. We're in America, and I don't have to bake your vile cake. Somebody else could come in and say, I want you to create a cake for me that has demonic images on it, because it's Halloween, and I really love demonic, sick images, ghoulish stuff. And you could say to them, well, you know, I'm a Christian, and I feel uncomfortable with that. And there are other bakers down the street or across town. I'm sure they'd be willing to do that for you. But you know what? I don't want to do that. In America, you can say that. In America, you can say all kinds of things. People can disagree. It is our right to say things. It is our right to disagree. But it is not our right to force people to agree with us. That's what's happening around America. And I want to tell you, folks, if we don't step up now, as in now, giving to the Alliance Defending Freedom now something, you're going to have yourself to blame when this stuff gets uglier and uglier. Now is the time to fight back. I write about it in my Bonhoeffer book. If you've read that book, you know that the German Christians didn't speak up at first. They were very shy, very polite, very sweet. And then their rights were taken away and they couldn't speak up. I say this to you from the bottom of my heart. This is the right thing to do. So I'm saying, please give to the Alliance Defending Freedom. The one way you can give is you can just go to our website, MetaxasTalk.com. At MetaxasTalk.com, you'll see the banner for ADF. If you'd rather pick up a phone, I'd love for you to do that. And again, any amount, folks, we don't care. We're going to enter you in a grand prize drawing to win a ton of stuff, signed books, including my new 10th anniversary Bonhoeffer edition. Oh, that's handsome. And we are going to enter you no matter how much you give. So you can call this phone number right now. I hope you will. Please, we need you to help. We need everybody to do something. The number is 855-547-5333. That's 855-547-5333. I'll say it again. 855-547-5333. We really need your help. America needs your help. Your fellow Americans need your help. Doesn't matter where you stand politically. This is the right thing to do. And any amount would be swell. So if you answered no to that question, please do that. God bless you.